The following sermon by Dr. Harry Schomburg was preached at First Baptist Church, Black Forest, Colorado.
The subject this morning is one that often is not talked about, particularly on a Sunday morning service, but even in other forms of public gatherings. I, on the other hand, in specializing and working in this area for the last 28 years, will find myself having some very interesting conversations in restaurants and wonder what people are thinking who may be sitting in the booth next to us in terms of what we're talking about. So I'm very comfortable with the subject, but I realize there may be some real discomfort, and there's a lot of reasons for that. It's something private, but also it can be something that can be very hidden and secretive, and we're going to look at that this morning. And we need to talk about this, and I was delighted when Pastor Bob contacted me, as I am with any invitation to speak, because I think this is one of the most important subjects for the church today, that we really address this and we really begin to deal with it. Pornography, one form of sexual sin, is certainly the most prevalent problem that we have in the church today. And we're going to look at that a little bit more closely, just how prevalent the problem is. In addressing this subject, I want to basically look at the idea that sexual sin does exist, to define what sexual sin is, and then to look at two responses to the problem, two mutually exclusive responses to the problem, because we're either going to end up on one side or the other side. There's not any place in the middle where we can hide. So I'm going to do that in the form of three questions. Question number one, what is sexual sin? Question number two, where is sexual sin? And then that question, what should be our response to sexual sin? So very simple outline in order to deal with a very difficult and in some ways complex subject. Each of us is a sexual being. We are either male or female. And there's a lot of complexity just wrapped up in our masculinity and our femininity. So the first question, what is sexual sin? I like to use the term sexual sin rather than the term sexual addiction. Though sexual addiction is the popular term, and the book I wrote some years ago, back in 1990, has the term sexual addiction in the title of the book, as well as it appears throughout the book. But I prefer to use the word sexual sin, because I think as we begin to grapple with this problem in our individual lives, when we begin to grapple with this problem in our marriages, and certainly in our families, and we have to grapple with it in our church, there's a tendency to use the term sexual addiction, and I use it, and it's very common. I just want to be able to define it. I think ultimately the problem is not sexual addiction. In other words, what I'm saying is we're not ultimately dealing with an addiction, as we would understand drug addiction, heroin addiction, alcoholism. Right away we have a frame of reference. We say, okay, I understand addiction. The heroin addict can't stop taking heroin. The cocaine addict can't stop taking cocaine. The cigarette smoker can't stop smoking. The alcoholic can't stop drinking. And we understand the power that something like that, a substance, can grip a person and control their lives and drag them down and destroy not only their lives, their marriages, but maybe even their careers. So we call that an addiction. And it's a good metaphor of understanding the power that is there and the bondage that is there. But I think as Christians in particular, as we address this problem, we need to be more careful in defining it as sin, because I think it's a much better word. So I would disagree with the statement using the word addiction helps us define the qualities of sin. I would disagree with that statement. Using the word addiction helps define the qualities of sin. I would disagree. I think it actually helps diminishes an understanding of the qualities of sin, which is so essential in terms of a real cure or a real change or to have this problem done with in our lives. I would agree with the statement that the gospel is never more plain. The gospel is never more plain. The gospel is never more powerful as when sin is clearly sin. And one of my concerns about calling the problem sexual addiction is that we actually diminish the power of the gospel. I am more convinced after spending 28 years dealing with this problem throughout all of my counseling career that we have to deal with it from the standpoint of sin, and we have to deal with it from the standpoint of the gospel. Now, one of the problems with that statement, if you're sitting here and you've struggled with it for many, many years, perhaps secretly as a Christian, you're saying, but I've prayed, I've come to the altar, and I've prayed, and nothing has happened. So the gospel doesn't work, or it's not working in my life. And so that's part of the challenge, and I think as we go through this morning, but also this evening and Monday evening, it'll be clear that it is the gospel that is the power to really change people's hearts and lives. When we lose that, and we could lose that battle right in the issue of sexual addiction or sexual sin, we're in trouble. We're in serious trouble. So I may be challenging some of your assumptions. That's okay. That's what I'm here to do. Colossians chapter 3 is a very, very key verse. And if you have a Bible, or I don't notice if you have those in your pews here in this church, but if you have one handy, turn to it, because I'd like you to look at the passage. And I'm going to be reading in the English Standard Version, which is a little bit different than the more popular NIV, but basically pretty much says the same thing. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you. Now that verse is loaded in terms of what it is saying to our contemporary therapeutic culture. It's just loaded. In fact, it contradicts everything in our therapeutic culture. First off, it says put to death. I always thought death was terminal. That means it's something to be done with. And once something is dead, it's so final, to state the obvious, it never comes back to life again. Apart from the resurrection of Christ, apart from our own resurrection, there is no life after death. It's finished. It's over with. Paul is saying here, put to death. Therefore, well, what is the therefore? And there's so much that you could read. In fact, every verse that precedes this needs to be read. And it's a very complex passage, but every single word, every single phrase that precedes this needs to be read to understand the therefore. Otherwise, the word therefore just sounds like a familiar word and doesn't carry a tremendous amount of weight. Let me just give you a slight picture of what is being said before this verse. In chapter 1, if you back up a bit to the second half of verse 9, Paul has never been to this church, probably never visited this church, but has heard about their conversion, and he's been praying for them ever since because he knows how important the struggles that they're going to have are and how important it is for them to effectively deal with it. And he says, I've been praying for you. I've been asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding so as to walk. So notice the phrase, so as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him. We who have come to Christ are to walk in a manner worthy of what we were singing about this morning. We are to walk in a manner worthy of the cross and fully pleasing to him. That's our obligation. Now that isn't, we don't do that to get our salvation. Our salvation is by grace. I believe in grace alone. But now that we have, by grace, this tremendous salvation that this church has experienced, that I assume many of you have experienced, we are to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Therefore, that's the therefore. But again, you'd have to read every verse before to get even more of the weight of what Paul is saying in that little word, therefore. Put to death, therefore, because you're to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, well, fully pleasing to him. Therefore, put to death what is earthly in you. Now, there's not a single person in the hearing of my voice that doesn't have something very earthy, very earthly in you. We're all there. There's not a single person. If the room had infants in the room, they would have something, as sweet little cute babies, something earthly within them that is going to have to be put to death. This is a universal condition each and every one of us must address as those who are going to walk worthy of the Lord Jesus Christ, fully pleasing to him. We have to put to death what is earthly. We have to put to death what is earthly in you. Now, in contrast to the common held view of the therapeutic culture that surrounds us, we would have to put to death, if you will, our family of origin. Because immediately, people grappling with sexual sin, sexual addiction, will say, well, my father was an alcoholic. I grew up and I was abused, and on and on and on and on. My family of origin issues. I've been a counselor long enough, you can tell by the gray hair. I've been a counselor long enough where I remember where we as counselors didn't talk about the family of origin. And we certainly would have talked about it in the church as being the primary influence for who we are and what we're about. But the Bible says, in terms of who we are and what we're about and what we have to deal with and what we have to put to death because it's earthly and it's in us, has nothing to do with our family of origin. It is what is earthly, our sinful nature, what is in us. We've got to put it to death. Okay, so what's the specifics of that? And that brings us right into the definition. What is sexual sin? Sexual immorality. Now that's the, of course, English. It's unfortunate that most of us don't know what that word would look like in the Greek, because right away it might perk some curiosity. The word here, sexual immorality, in the Greek is porneia. Isn't that an interesting word? Porneia. And of course it's immediately recognizable because of the first four letters, porn. It's actually where we get our word pornography from. Porn plus graph equals sexually explicit picture. Porn graph, pornography. That's where we get the word from. Now, if you go and study this word and you look at the word porneia, what you're going to find is that originally, this is very important in terms of understanding and defining sexual sin, is that originally the word had to do with anything that was excessive and where there was a lack of restraint. See how that sounds like addiction? What we would use as modern addiction? Anything that was excessive, drug use, anything that was out of control, lack of restraint, alcoholism, anything. That's what the original Greek word meant. Eventually, the word came to apply exclusively to a lack of control in terms of sexual desire or sexual sin, any sexual excess or any sexual indulgence. So by the time that Paul is writing the New Testament, a couple of thousand years ago, the word porneia means sexual immorality. It has only a limited meaning now, or more limited meaning, referring to sexual excess or indulgent lack of restraint. That's what the word means. It's a good word. Now, we can define this word further in terms of three things: behavior, internal disposition, and attitude. And that's exactly what Paul does here. If you read this verse very carefully, and if you pull out a commentary, and you want to study what these words mean, if you want to look them up in the English dictionary and not even use a commentary, just start looking at the words that he is using here to define further what is sexual immorality. Sexual immorality is first impurity. Impurity. And we kind of know what that word means without looking it up in the dictionary, but impurity has to do with anything that is filthy. The best picture would be human refuse or a dead carcass. I remember a number of years ago, I go up and down Black Forest Road all the time because I live just north of the north side of the edge of Black Forest on the north side. And I remember just for a couple of days having to go down and back on Black Forest Road. And it just was, how long was that dead skunk going to lie there and reek and smell up the neighborhood? We've all experienced that. That's what we're talking about here, impurity. Some dead, smelly, foul skunk along the side of the road. So now we look at an airbrushed picture in terms of pornography and go, wow. No, get the reality here. It's a dead carcass, and it reeks because it's dead, and maybe it even reeks more if it's a dead skunk. It's that foul. That's the definition here of sexual immorality. That's the internal disposition, first impurity. A second part of the internal disposition is passion. We have passions. Paul talks about this in Romans. We have passions that we are to put our passions. He talks about this in Romans. Put our passions to death. To death, because what are passions do? They drive us. There's a drivenness to sexual sin. And then evil desire is kind of along very much the same line of passion, but an inordinate craving, an out of balance, out of whack craving for sexual satisfaction. So that's the internal disposition. The behavior, you got to understand, sexual immorality or porneia includes everything. Everything. It includes everything from premarital sex to the woman you married, or the husband, the man you married, that you were involved with premaritally. That's porneia. It includes masturbation, in my opinion. It includes bestiality. It includes incest. It includes prostitution. And, of course, it includes pornography. It includes homosexuality. It includes everything. Those, think of all of those as behaviors. And then you have the internal disposition of impurity, passion, and evil desire. But here's the interesting thing, almost like two bookends. Sexual immorality, the behavior, but what's the attitude? Where's the mindset? Where are we thinking? And so the final word Paul uses is covetousness, or I think the NIV says greed. But this word is different in that he defines it by saying, which is idolatry. So what are we talking about? Sexual sin is all about self-seeking, which is, of course, true of all sin. All sin is a matter of essentially a worship of ourselves, making ourselves more important. And in particular, in terms of sexual immorality, we're so important that the person goes out and does something that may endanger them legally, may endanger them in terms of their health, may endanger them in terms of their career, their occupation, their income, and their family. Idolatry is a strange word because immediately we think of the Old Testament, of course, and we think of those graven images. We think, well, we don't have a problem with that. Of course, that's just a total inappropriate understanding of idolatry. Let me just define idolatry this way. It's simply a desire to get. That's all idolatry is. All idolatry is. And so why do you create a carved image to get? Because then if you have the carved image, you got what you need to get what you want. We're more sophisticated. We skip that step and we just go get what we want. Idolatry. Which leads to the next point. Where is sexual sin? I've defined it, but where is it? Where does it exist? This is where it's easy to tune out within the church, because it's going to lead to the final question, what's our response? 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul is writing, of course, to another church. And in verse 1 he says this, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality, same word, porneia, among you. Where does sexual sin exist? The topless bar somewhere in Colorado Springs, the X-rated bookstore, the prostitute wandering the street in the downtown area of Colorado Springs? Sure. A hotel room where a couple meet for an adulterous relationship, that's where it exists. Where does it exist? Among us. And that includes in the church. And of course, today, in the world of the internet, it is literally going on in the church in the form of looking at computers that are in the church office. We get people all the time coming from all over the United States to our counseling program, our 8-day intensive counseling program, where they were caught with pornography on the church computer in the church office, whether it's a senior pastor, associate pastor, or whoever. So it's actually the sin is going on, the behavior is literally going on in the four walls of the church. Years ago, I don't think you'd ever think about bringing a pornographic magazine into your church office or bringing a video and putting it in your VCR in the church office. Too risky. Now all you do, point, click, boom, there, boom, gone. It's right in the church in the literalest sense that you could think of it, but it's among us. Indications, and that's a very key word in terms of what I want to say, because I don't think we have hard scientific evidence, but the indications ought to wake us up in terms of where is it. Indications are, I think, if we want to think clearly and accurately and respond correctly, we need to think in terms of half the congregation is probably struggling with internet pornography. Say, that's pretty startling, Harry. What are the indications of that? Again, I'm not saying that necessarily is true, but I think we need to think about the indicators, and then we need to think, is it that prevalent? Because if it is, we got a problem, to say the least. What are the indicators? By the way, amongst teenagers, the indicators would be 70%. Well, we know this from surveys and studies, 20% of men, but here's a startling figure, 13% of women access pornography at work every day. That's not 50%, but it's going on at work. That doesn't mean that that's the only percentage of people, but at work, 20% of men, 13% of women. 12 to 17-year-olds are the largest consumers of pornography. It's not the adult man. It's the 12 to 17-year-olds who are the largest consumers of pornography in the United States today. One out of three visitors to adult websites are now women. People go, when did that happen? I thought this is a male problem. We got to think different. One out of three. 90%, you may have read this, it was even reported in the Springs paper, 90% of 8 to 16-year-olds have viewed pornography while doing their homework. 90%. Well, and if you read the little blurb in the Springs Gazette, it said, well, you know, some of those are just pop-ups, and the kids looking at it just click the X mark and, you know, shut it down right away. That's all that ever happened. That's rather naive from my perspective, because in my counseling experience, long before the internet ever came into existence, every single person that I ever counseled, virtually every single person, when they told you, when did you start looking at pornography, they were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age. Where did they find it? They found a stash of it in their father's garage or attic or basement. You see the problem. Not every house, I didn't find it in my house, not every house had it hidden somewhere. Now, if you have internet access, it's in your house. And that little pop-up for a minute is equivalent to the 8-year-old a number of years ago who just stumbled onto it, became curious, and kept going back and looking at it, and would identify 20 years, 40 years later, that's when it all began. That is a scary, scary statistic. I have worked with two Christian organizations that are international, broad in scope, that recruit people to be involved in Christian ministry, and I'm deliberately being vague, not wanting to identify these organizations. I say there are only two, but they're two completely different organizations. They have no connection to one another. One organization, and I've worked with them extensively, says, what do we do with the fact that 80% of our missionary candidates on voluntary questioning indicate that they have a struggle with pornography? We don't know about the other 20%. Those are the only 80% said yes to the question when asked three times. That's an indicator. Another organization that trains people for ministry, being very vague in terms of what that is, the head of the organization said, we have yet to interview a candidate for this ministry who hasn't admitted to a struggle with pornography. And he said, in most cases, the wives don't even know yet. That's 100% in that organization. One seminary told me, we no longer ask the question, is the student struggling with pornography when he enters the seminary? We assume every student, it's an interdenominational seminary, every student that comes in and starts school here, we assume they're struggling with pornography. The question is, how serious is the struggle? Do you see the implications there? Do you see the indicators there? The indicators, I think, represent two things: potential and reality. An incredible potential for all kinds of horrible, destructive things, not just the sexual sin itself. Now, here's one other thing you have to read in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. There's actually sexual immorality reported among us. But then Paul describes a particular case. That's not the only problem. Apparently, it's more widespread than this one case. A man has his father's wife, probably not his mother. But this is what Paul says about that: a kind of sexual immorality that is not tolerated even amongst pagans. See, that's in the church too. We have a sexual immorality going on in the church that's not even tolerated amongst pagans. I could stand here for the rest of the time that I have and give you case-by-case examples of situations that I've worked with. I'll just give you one. I'm still working with the church. I've worked with the parties involved. A married woman in the congregation, a church of only 50 people, 50 people in attendance on a Sunday morning, small church. You can imagine the impact. A married woman had an adulterous relationship, a one-year affair with a 15-year-old adolescent, the pastor's son. That's not even tolerated amongst the pagans. That's against the law in all 50 states of America, but right within the church. So, I think you're getting to the point, and we're getting to hopefully the point I want to make, and that is, how do we respond? Unfortunately, there were two responses. I think there were only ultimately two responses. If we do nothing, that's one response. These two responses are, as I said, mutually exclusive. The first one is avoidance. And you can obviously, I hope, as your heart and minds are open this morning to what I've had to say, you can obviously realize that avoidance is a dumb response. It's that proverbial sticking your head in the sand, to say the least. Avoidance is just not a viable response. But being a person who travels and speaks and writes and counsels on this subject within the evangelical church, I have to tell you, and we've had over 2,000 people come to Colorado from all across the United States in the evangelical world, and every indication is we're sticking our head in the sand within the evangelical church. That's why I just am thrilled when I get an invitation like this, especially on a Sunday morning, to speak out about this problem, because it shows at least some level of concern. And that has to be applauded. Why would anyone avoid this problem? Well, of course, if you have the problem personally, I can tell you, with a countless number of people that I've counseled, almost 2,000 in the last 16 years, maybe 5 came forward. Everyone else was caught. What does that tell you? Well, pretty obvious. If you've got this problem, you don't want anyone to know. It's pretty obviously why. The shame, the horrible consequences. If my wife knew, if my husband knew, I dread to think what would be the consequences. So we keep it hidden. I'm becoming more of the opinion that in understanding the sovereignty of God, I really believe that if God loves you and you're a child of God, every single sin like that it is hidden will be exposed in your lifetime sometime. It's either going to happen when you're 19 or it's going to happen when you're 70, but it's going to happen. And when it happens, it's not going to be pretty. And all I'm trying to say is take the necessary steps now, because to not deal with it, to avoid this, and if it's in your marriage and you're married to someone who is struggling and you're avoiding it, there's the same issue. Take the steps necessary. More importantly, and this has become my most important point, we cannot as a church afford to avoid this problem amongst teenagers. If you've got 3-year-olds, it's only 5 years from today that they'll be 8 and in that 90%. What are you doing now? So there's nobody that can stand back and go, I don't think we have this problem, if 90% have already seen pornography on the internet. Why would we do that? Why would we jeopardize our own kids? Why would we jeopardize our own lives? Why would we jeopardize our own souls? Why would we jeopardize our own marriages? Paul makes it very, very clear in this passage. He says, ought you not rather to mourn? That's the response we're to have. But you are arrogant. Any avoidance of this problem in yourself, in your marriage, the potential within your own kids, and don't just think a filter is going to do it. It's not. Any avoidance of this comes down to the very harsh words of Paul here, arrogance. You can just see it, you can just feel it, the sense that we don't have to deal with this. We really can avoid this. We don't have to get into the mess. It's too difficult, it's too messy. It'll just go away. That's arrogance. It won't do any more harm. I'm not sleeping with a prostitute. I'm only looking at pornography. That's avoidance. That's arrogance. What's the alternative response? Well, within the church, gentle confrontation. Gentle confrontation. Confrontation, but gentle. And if you want a scriptural reference for that, Galatians 6:1. Restore gently when someone is caught in sin. I've heard some horrible stories in the church across America. One pastor got caught with pornography on his computer. He asked his church after they fired him, he said, would you at least help me with the finances necessary to go to Colorado to this counseling program? And they said, no, you don't deserve it. That was mean at that level. But the meanness got worse. In the mail, he got an envelope. Inside was all the money he needed to come to our counseling program. The problem was it was monopoly money. That's a mocking, that's a meanness that violates everything that I see in Scripture, let alone Galatians 6:1. And if you want a really important understanding of Scripture in terms of how we need to respond, it would be Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15, where the writer of Hebrews says, see to it That's a pretty strong exhortation, I think. See to it. Take care. Look carefully. Many ways you could reword that. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. See to it that no root of bitterness springs up. But the third see to it that no one is sexually immoral. And the fourth one is no one is unholy like Esau. The neat thing about speaking this morning that I like is that everyone can respond in terms of what Pastor Bob will say this morning, but even tonight. And just hear what I have to say from, think of it from a pastor's heart, a counselor's heart, a father's heart, maybe a grandfather's heart. I believe with all my heart there's not a single one of us, short of having to go to the emergency room this afternoon, who shouldn't be here tonight in order to not demonstrate that arrogance and in order to demonstrate that we're really taking this seriously and we want to address this problem, whether it's in our own kids, the potential, our own grandkids, or whether it's in our own lives, whatever it is. So what we have to say, what we want to talk about this evening, it pertains to each and every single person who will hear this morning and hear this in the second service. Thank you so much.